Annette, welcome to the podcast and thank you so much for joining us today. So Annette is the CEO of Jackson Teese, and we're going to be having a little bit of a chat about where we see things in the future ahead. So Annette, tell us a little bit about Jackson Teese.
Thank you for having me. Jackson Teese has been around for nearly over 50 years now, and I've worked at Jackson Teese before. This is my second time around. And first time I was here for 4 years, and the second time I'm being here for now 8 months. And so we're a bit of a sleeper architectural practice, and we've been in Brisbane and in Sydney for a long time, and we've also got an office in Japan and a satellite office in China and Taiwan. So we focus on the Southeast Asia market. 50% of our business is in seniors living and residential care. And the other 50% is in straight resi. So we are pretty much the living sector specialists. We do build to rent, build to sell, co-living. We do childcare centres. We do some historic buildings, beautiful buildings. We're doing one at the moment. So we do have a broad range of experience.
For somebody who's been in the industry for many years, I know Jackson Teese quite well, and I would say, you know, you are very much a leading design brand and obviously have been for – now, Jackson Teese has been around for how many years?
Over 50 years.
Yeah, 50 years, and is very much one of those, I feel, one of those leading design brands where, yeah, it's probably, you know, different times and places. So tell us a little bit about Asia as well, and obviously having an office in Japan and the focus and the growth there.
So we were in China. We've been in China for 10 years.
Wow.
And a lot of the work that we did in northern and southern China have been in the residential care and seniors living market because they have an aging population. Yeah. And traditionally, the eldest child helps the parents as they get older. But now traditions have changed and they are the – you know, children are going abroad and they're not looking after their family. So as they get older, the parents are needing more care. And so we came in as specialists to help some pretty large practices in China to, you know, help them design these facilities, and they're thousands and thousands of units in one facility. So, I mean, the work that we've done there, and a lot of it's been is under construction at the moment, being very vast in comparison to what we do here in Australia. The work we do in Japan, we've been in Japan for about 8 years now, and Japan is a really interesting sector to be in, if I can call it that. Their authority approval is quite different to Australia. They've already got the envelope or approved, and you build a unit. So there's the height limit. You can't breach heights, and you can't breach setbacks or anything like that. So
there's no negotiation, no sort of bullshit.
And
yeah.
So it's how do you work within that space, which is quite interesting. So we've done work in Shibuya, which is it's almost like a trans-oriented development with really cool brands underneath, and there's a park on top. So if you're ever in Japan. In Tokyo.
I will now.
Go visit it because it's really beautiful.
Amazing. And I mean, that really gives, I suppose, your team as well a broad mix. Is it something that your team works on, both projects in Australia and international projects as well?
Mm-hmm. And I've worked in many practices where the size that we are, we could be siloed if we wanted to be. But what we've tried to do is have our staff understand multiple sectors so that if something came along later on down the track that is in Japan or is in China, that they're able to work on it as well, because Japan and the Chinese work have kept us going during the tough times.
Yeah.
And we have it, so we've been able to retain all our staff as a result. That's been quite lucrative from that perspective.
Oh, look, and I think it's one of those things. It's, I suppose, you know, as somebody who's travelled the world quite a lot, you know, and you look at so many folios from people across the globe, it's quite funny. The first thing people are always like, oh, you must have Australian experience, which I completely understand for understanding the BCA and NCC. But at the same time, architecture is international, right?
Yes.
And the size and the scale of the projects in Australia, just due to the size of our population and the size of our economy, are actually quite small. And it's amazing how many firms, you know, sort of think about Asia, but always haven't necessarily successfully grown or grown it past several different countries or may just be in one region. And I mean, the world is massive and it makes a lot of sense for Australia to be focusing on supporting other countries within our region versus always thinking the first thing seems to be, let's go to the UK, let's go to the US. Now, is some of that also a bit of what some of the requirements are? From my understanding in China, you know, you do need to have some local architects on the ground.
We have someone that used to work with us here in Australia who moved to China with her child. And so she's been almost like a translator for us, but we do have a partner in China, and it's good because then they can use our name to bring work in for themselves as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. And how large is Jackson Heath to date? We are talking in April of 2026.
We're about 60 now, which is great.
Yeah.
I don't want to grow it too much bigger than what it is at the moment. There's a sweet spot, and if you want to talk about sweet spots in and I've worked in practices that are over 100, one that was over 200.
Well, I think that's actually great. We don't necessarily ask that, but because you've got that business background, and we'll go through a bit of your background, we always just sort of follow where the conversation goes. I mean, that is actually one of the things, right? Like if you look at architecture firms across Australia, about 75-80% of firms are actually sort of under 10. Yes. And then you look at the next size, there's not many firms. People always have this big picture, right? But I find, you know, I've worked in companies where we've grown it from 90 to 200, okay? Mm. And, you know, and having big is great for some things. And this will be interesting when we get to the conversation of the future as well. But it is definitely a different feel from 60 to 200 and then 200 to 500 and then we get to more of the multidisciplinary. What's your thoughts on that? All right, so tell us about what do you think is that really nice sweet spot for architecture firms?
Yeah, there is actually a few sweet spots. And because I've worked in different scale businesses, I can tell you what those numbers are.
Great, let's talk about it.
So my rule of thumb has always been one director for 10 people.
The old 1 to 10. Yep, that is the old rule. Yeah,
and it does work. But when it gets bigger than that, the model has to change.
Mm.
So, yes, you can have one director for 10 people, but you do have to have a 2IC that stays in the office so that you can go out and bring work.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the next size up is the 25 number. 25 is where your operational team starts to get bigger.
Mm.
And then you start to have to look at how much overhead can your business sustain and afford.
Mm.
And then the next number up, you're actually around the 60 mark.
Yeah.
Right. And that's where you have multiple directors or studio directors, however you've arranged your org chart. And then the next big number, we're sitting around 85 to 90.
Yeah.
And then from there, it's almost like looking at having one director, a senior associate, about two or three senior architects, about 20 in the middle, which are your production people, and then three or four juniors, right? It's almost like a diamond rather than a pyramid.
Yeah. Right?
So that's how I've always worked out work teams and scaling up. If you're looking at scaling up, that's how you need to do it.
Yeah.
So you need multiple rainmakers, but the main person will – If you want to go to 25, you need at least two or three rainmakers, not just one.
Yeah. And I think it's always those things. You see these different parts where firms, organisations in general, they hit these points, which depending on what the organisation is, so architecture firms, we sort of know what the general salary ranges are. You know, PM firms might be a bit different because the salaries are a lot different. You know, engineering, same, a bit different again. But in essence, I agree with you. I mean, I've written, this is what we do. We do outsource HR for companies. We do recruitment, training and development. And this is a big thing that I've worked on is different models of what you're scaling. And as we often talk about that pyramid, but it's more in the progression of your career. Absolutely. It does look like more of a diamond. I've done things up sometimes to 23, right? But again, it's all about what is the potential for those rainmakers or that person, what income is coming in to actually support that team.
That's right.
And that's the biggest thing. And I think that's, you know, we're skipping a few things here, but I feel like that may continue to develop and change over the next 10 to 20 years as we see the tech changing. And I mean, at the end of the day, AI is just another tool, right? The same as Revit came in was another tool, or 3D CAD was a difference. And I'd love to talk about your background and sort of what you've seen as well. But there definitely is different elements and different stages that firms will go through. I think there's also a difference within the timelines as well. So seeing, you're talking about a firm that is 50 years old, you're also going through generations as well. And it's also the interesting part, you may see a firm grow within one generation. How does it continue on past that brand of which was the original partners or those who were the original brand? And how do you actually keep that? Because there's not very many firms. Your firm is one of the very few firms around who is probably, I'd say, third generation now.
We are third generation.
And it's that next part of the fourth and the fifth. And, you know, we look at our, you know, your big guys at your Hassels and your Woods, which become more, and Architectus is another thing in itself. And then you look at these other firms who are going through that, who gets to the 200 years type stuff. Do you have thoughts on that as well? What the difference is?
I've worked with many businesses about succession, and McConnell Smith & Johnson was one of my first major jobs. And AJC and Jackson Tees came out of McConnell Smith & Johnson. So the directors from there came across. So David Chesterman, Jackson Tees is actually Jackson Tees Chesterman Willis.
Oh, right. How did I not know that? Maybe I haven't been around long enough.
Trading as Jackson Tees. And that happened maybe about 20 years ago. We dropped the Chesterman Willis.
Yeah.
But companies come out of other companies, right? So, and I think that that's beautiful in itself. But to maintain that succession and that brand across multiple generations, that is effort in itself, because in the background, the plan for the business needs to include the next generation, the ones that are sitting at that senior associate studio director role that aren't yet partners within the business. But how do you entice them to stay, or how do you go out to the market and find the right fit for the business? So that is something that I'm working on with Jackson Tees. And the beautiful thing about it is that everybody's on board. The current directors are on board with it, because they want to see this business flourish to 200 years and plus.
Yeah.
But my job is to make sure that that happens. I've doubled the business in the last 8 months. And we're in a position where we will bring in partners that we've been, because I was here before, I promoted some of the staff members to the roles that they're in at the moment. So I have the beauty of bringing them into a partnership within the business so that they can see their career through with us.
Yeah.
But as I mentioned before, when you do start to grow, you need to also market for it, because the one person that used to bring in the work for the business when we were 20 people, well, they want to, you know, retire or semi-retire in the future. How do we then leverage that for ourselves moving forward and for us to bring in potential new clients or build new relationships with new people, but also maintaining the relationships that we have with our current clients? Because some of our clients have been with us for 20 years.
And is that, I mean, this is, I suppose, the next thing too. It's where you, as you said, businesses come out of businesses. Some people leave, they start a new business. Sometimes businesses merge with businesses. There's a difference and depends on the strategy of those businesses at the time. Right. Definitely. And I think it's one of those things we often talk about, like only 5%, yes, we're doing rough numbers here. Like we generally talk about the hunters or the people who are going to be work winners. It's about with architects, it's less for some other disciplines, it's more for other disciplines. Probably as a rough number, about 5-10% may actually do that. And the interesting thing is that they also have other options themselves. You know, they have the option to go and start their own firm, which is hard to start any business. You know, 90% of businesses fail within the first 5 years. It's also a lot more expensive with insurances and things like tech and stuff like that as well. But there are heaps of businesses out there who really, and people are just like, you know, and it's because we work with all different sizes. People are just like being 5 or 10 and they don't want to be more than 10, right? They've been
perfectly fine.
And then there's people who go, actually, I want to create something that's a legacy, or I want to go after that big work. And that big work means we need to be building a team that has a substantial size and talent that can do that. I think it is, though, where do you see that you start to also build in that mentality of people understanding how important it is to actually win work and to learn those skills to actually become a future work winner?
So I always like to start quite early. When I'm on board, there's a lot of people that follow me everywhere I go. And at Jackson Teeth, we have one or two people that have followed me four times.
So you just come with your own team.
They just come. And honestly, they could be admin, they could be architecture, interiors. They just keep following me. And that's because I've always been very honest with them. If I feel that they're lacking a certain aspect within their career trajectory or growth, I will tell them and I will say, this is how we'll fix it and this is how we will enable you to, you know, hero your strengths rather than your weaknesses. So when we talk about when's the right time to start helping our staff with bringing in work, is one of the best things is to bring in work through work. So if you end a conversation with a client, it's almost like, so what else have you got on at the moment?
Yeah. Or, it's a simple thing, isn't it?
It's very simple. And and it's almost like, for example, we're doing the architecture, who's doing the interiors? Or how is your interior designer going on this project? Are you happy with what they're delivering? But not, we don't want to be taking projects off other architects because I don't believe in that. It's more about how do we start teaching our staff that we can start doing it very early on. Or one thing that I've instilled in our staff is at your level, if you're coordinating with consultants at your level, who are the people that are that you're communicating externally with?
Yeah.
So let's say I'm a senior project lead and I'm coordinating with the engineers, for example, and the structural engineer, et cetera. We have a meeting. After the meeting, it's, so what else have you got on your books? Do you have an architect on that project? And when they start to hear that, then they will associate you with someone who wants to win work and they'll be like, okay, Lynette, remember how you were talking about last week? We have an architect on this project. We actually don't have an architect on this project.
Yeah.
Would you look at it? Of course I will. I'm happy to. So sometimes just teaching and instilling those very small, minor conversational starters can actually yield work.
Well, and it's amazing because it is just about habits. I mean, we do some training on this stuff, and that's half of it is just getting into routine habits. And so it's, you know, you go to McDonald's, right, and they'll ask, would you like fries with that? Do you want to upsize that? It's not in the same way, but it is just that asking those simple questions sometimes, or understanding that you're going to win work through the relationships. And I think that's one of the things I've always loved about the built environment is that everybody it is a network. Right. And everybody is intertwined. And, you know, sometimes people working at this firm, they'll be working at that firm. But the one thing that you take as an individual is your network as you go around as That's well. And it's fundamental. And we work with people on this too, of building your graduate programs, that is what you're doing, building relationships up with other people in the industry, understanding what they do. Because guess what? They've got to do exactly the same thing as well. So, you know, the engineer will be needing to be thinking about that as well. And they'll be wanting to know, is there anything that you're working on that they could potentially help with as well? And I think it's, you think about it, and it's one of those interesting things because, you know, I've often thought about this. It's one element of our business, but, you know, you look at recruitment firms and you think, God, how does it get to that size? Literally all of their team is constantly doing BD every day. Whereas if you think about, if you have one person making phone calls and doing that and constantly versus we said 1 to 10 or 1 to 20 or whatever your ratio that you want to work it out, it's different. And if it just becomes that little part that people are doing or understanding, I think the biggest thing is it's about mindset. Often I find with architects is that they often think that sales or business development can be a negative thing and can be something that isn't something that they want to do. But actually, if you think about it and rephrase it, it's about getting great opportunities. You don't get to work on good work if you don't know what's out there, or if you don't ask for it, or if you don't continue to build on that as well. All right. Look, we've gone through quite some interesting things already. So would you mind just quickly sharing, you've obviously referenced some of the places that you've worked and what you've done. Do you want to give us a quick summary a bit about your background? Because you've got a very interesting one and where it led you to where you are today.
I do. I don't normally talk about this, but I did start, I grew up in Wollongong. So I did work for a small architectural practice in Austin Mere on the beach, doing beach houses, which was fantastic. But I did, my big role was at McConnell Smith & Johnson. I was there for a very long time. I commuted every day from Wollongong to Sydney for 7 years. But then after I graduated, I got a job at Zahn's, and so I worked directly with Alec, which was quite an amazing experience for me and something that I draw on all the time. He was an inspiration and is an inspiration to me every day. I worked with Alec Zahn's for about 4 or 5 years, and that whole time I worked closely with him and I worked on lots of fantastic projects. But then I moved across to Willara Council. So I worked there for a little while and I found it very interesting to be on the other side.
Yeah. What did you learn from that?
Look, the people were amazing. It was a completely different way of thinking. I learned how to negotiate with neighbours, and, you know, at the time there was always objections. You know, you go to community consultations and the neighbours.
You just became a negotiator, really, mediator.
Fantastic. And I learned how to mediate really well from that perspective because you were dealing with lawyers living in the eastern suburbs. So trying to get your message across was quite, that was challenging. But in the end, I found it very, very rewarding. And then afterward, I worked with a builder who was a mate of mine. At the time, he was just purely construction. But we used to get a lot of inquiries for architectural. And that's where we joined forces and we became a design and construct business, which was
and
very
And that was A2 Architects or was that?
That was something that I had on my own with my husband. My husband's an architect as well. So that was a very lucrative side hustle.
Yeah.
So A Squared Architects was with my husband and I, and we still do work privately, but not under that name. But when I was at Home Impact Design and Build, we worked with marketers to get, get our feelers out there. That was a very lucrative exercise. I was there for a little while, but we only looked after the inner west.
Right.
So we just did a ring around that, and we became the inner west experts.
Well, I think that's one of the things in Sydney, right? Like, it's very, you kind of really need to choose a bit of a region, just because the cost of driving around it is enormous.
It really does help from that perspective, because we had our home base in the middle of Dulwich Hill and had a big construction team and a good mid-size architectural team.
Yeah.
The winning the work, I mean, we would sign up clients on the spot. Because
how
we
did
had
you get so good at it?
We had our sales pitch that was very honest. We went through the contract with them in front of their faces. Like, we went through it with them, and we went through word by word. We showed them where they would come up to any issue, and we worked with their budget. In the end, it was a design and construct company where this was the architecture fee and this is the construction budget. We will work to that construction budget. You make changes out of your brief, it'll increase or decrease your construction budget, but we will tell you every step of the way when that happens in advance, so you can make a decision which way you want to go. So that was very helpful for them.
Oh, and I must say, I mean, we've had this conversation with Kevin from Co-Architecture, right, that obviously works with a lot of small firms. And we were talking about that, and it is one of the biggest things that people go, oh, it's design. It's like, start with the budget first. Know what the construction costs. We were even going to do something. We're like, hang on, I need to get the builder in to tell me what are we looking at per square meter in costs, and then I can tell you what we can start with and then build. And it's interesting. That is why, especially for smaller projects, a lot of people go to D&C because they know what that is and it works with that. But
and it works. And it truly does, because we could give them a per square meter cost for refurbishing their old part of their house.
Yeah.
Anything that was cut and new, that was a completely different square meter rate. Then I moved on to, I went to Genton, where I was a practice manager in Melbourne and Sydney. The bigger office was in Melbourne, so I did a lot of commuting between the two offices. But I helped them also win the powerhouse competition at the time.
Yeah, wow.
In Parramatta. And then I moved to Jackson Tees. So that's where I did my first round here for 4 years, and then AJC for 2, and then back here again.
Yeah.
So that in the last 30 years, I mean, I've been able to go from architecture to construction to working, you know, in local government. And now, you know, in a more, I suppose, executive role.
Yeah.
Looking at things more strategically.
Well, and it's quite funny because, I mean, obviously practice management, it can be a bit similar in different firms, but you're dealing with what their niche in part is. I think what's also interesting, having ran your own company, right, and done that for the D&C, but it's what you were saying about actually what you were doing was finding the problem, solving a problem that people really wanted, which is, I want to build something, but I can only go to the bank and get this much, or I need to know what it is, and then that's going to actually tailor. How do you find that versus the mentality of when you then come back into high-end architecture and design firms and having that sort of problem solving to what the client actually wants? Is that something you sort of find in a mindset that you
versus very transferable, because no matter what the issue is, you've got to think on your feet, and working in so many different architectural practices and all the other places that I've worked at, it gives you that the experience to be able to do that. And the first thing I would say is listen to your client. Try and understand what it really is that they're after, and then say to them, so is this what you want?
Yeah.
And if they say yes, then you've understood what they're after. But if they say no, then you haven't. And then you've got to somehow extract it from them. And the only way to do that is also give them examples of how you've been able to resolve issues with other clients.
Mm.
And that way you're empathizing with them.
Yeah.
Because if there's no empathy there, then you're the architect and they're the client and there's no relationship.
And that's it. At the end of the day, you're working with somebody. It's a different problem you're solving, or who is the community you're helping, or what are you doing. But there's always constraints. You know, there's always parts, as you said, you know, working in Japan, you might need to work with the constraints of very strict planning regulations. But everybody has a constraint. Sometimes those are literally construction costs. Sometimes they are, you know, the different personalities of what's going on internally or what they need to get done to make the deal happen. Fascinating, absolutely fascinating. All right, so I'm looking at the time as well. Just where do you see some of the challenges in the industry at the moment?
I know a lot of people are talking about AI, but AI is, you mentioned it before, it's a tool and it will never be able to take the place of the face-to-face relationship that you would have with your client or consultants or what have you.
Mm.
They might help, AI could help us streamline how we operate, but I think that that's about it. You will find that AI might help with coming up with design concepts that you plug into the software, whatever it may be. But in the end, you need to be able to ensure that that building is buildable.
Mm.
And so that's just one thing. I feel that my biggest concern is the next generation coming into the architecture, the world of architecture in terms of the new recruits. I mentor at Western Sydney Uni in their built environment, which is their engineering and architecture. And I also work in UNSW and UTS. So what I'm finding is, yes, you get some real architects, but the majority of them are finding it very, very difficult to find a job. And they will say to me, I can't get a job because I don't have experience, but I can't get experience if I don't have a job. So it's almost that these offices need to give staff a chance, even if it's a 3-month internship, give them a go. Otherwise, you'll end up with no one in coming through that next generation.
Oh, and it's one of those things. I was working on a specialist role and we were talking about that. We're looking for a middler. And it's like, well, because COVID happened and, you know, there were some pluses once COVID, some injections, but we also lost quite a lot of people from the industry. And I think we've probably lost quite a few in different cities who are even more senior, who are going to the design management side or the project management side. And that's great for the industry overall, right? But that is the hardest thing. And I think that's the other thing is, you know, I think AI will automate a lot of things. Then how are we going to be training those people in what they need to know? Because, you know, garbage in, garbage out type terminology of if you don't know what you're doing or you need to actually have the knowledge to be able to direct something or to check it to know whether it's right or not. And I think we'll see lots of potential progressions in automating or making certain things. I mean, we've already seen this with computational design and domino scripting for the last, you know, few years, what can be done in and looking at different design factors. But if you don't actually know how things are constructed, if you don't understand that. And I think we've had this on quite a few podcasts and they'll be coming out in the coming weeks. And that's been one of the things. There are people who've come out during the GFC and I've asked them, I've said, look, can you talk about the story and what you've done there, because often people are. There was a really good answer that I think is worth sharing here too, is that at the end of the day, architects solve problems, right? So you need to look at it as a problem to solve. And I think what we've been talking in building relationships and winning work and understanding is the same thing. Sometimes it turns into a numbers game. But unfortunately, if you do want to be an architect, you are the canaries. You are going to go up and down. And firms do need to take on people. And I mean, at the end of the day, it makes a lot of fun. I'm sure as a practice manager, you look at it too. I can tell you as an HR manager, we go, you need to, because this is important for the structure of the business in the short term and the long term as well. But it is funny. You see this consistently when there is a downturn in the market. In 5+ years' time, you will be paying a lot more money for people who aren't as well experienced just because there is going to be a lack of people. And it's a cyclical cycle that you see. So firms do, I think it's great that you've mentioned that, but I also think it's really important for those coming out to think a little bit more laterally. And I think that's the great, you talked about working in Wollongong, you may not put it on your LinkedIn, but working for small firms is actually also something that's great. And I don't know about you, but working for mid to large firms as well, I always look at somebody who's worked for a small firm and they may have only worked on resi work, but they've got end to end.
That's right. And they're the ones that will understand where the printer is and how to print, as well as,
answer the phone.
Answer phones, yes. But they also can have a conversation with a client because they've been available in, you know, to be in those meetings with their boss.
Yeah.
When they're a small practice. But when they become, if they don't have the experience and they go into a larger practice, they can get lost. And then that mentoring starts to get diluted.
And look, and I would say that for anybody listening, if you are a graduate to having and you're finding it hard because the market may be quieter than normal. It sounds like you guys are growing, so well done you. But it is definitely, you know, cast your net wide. As I said, 80% of firms are under 10. There are a lot of sole practitioners out there and you might be working, but you get to work with somebody and see what it's like to win work and to do all of that, and it'll give you experience. And then, you know, it's always going to be that continuously building, and it is important as well. Excellent. Now, what do you see as some of the opportunities ahead as well and what people should be focused on?
I also think that this next generation is going to bring in some really great ideas. I do feel that we're in over the next 20 years, we'll be in a bit of a boom from an architectural perspective with the aging population and a housing shortage. So architects will, and the political climate that we have at the moment, and that the requirement for defence housing and as such, so that there will be a big push from the government to invest a lot of money, which they already have allocated a lot of money for construction in defence realm. But from a housing perspective, and especially a lot of the work that's happening in Western Sydney, I'm on the Western Sydney Property Committee, Council Committee, there is a lot of work happening around the airport there, and the way to draw people there is to create beautiful homes and
communities.
Parks. And
yeah.
So that super lot that in Bradfield that will be built, the first stage. So there is a lot that is happening, and we've got the Olympics in Brisbane. So Brisbane is starting to get their motor running almost.
Everybody expected it took a bit.
Not much has been happening. But I think in the next year or two we will start to see a lot of construction. Not that we actually have a skills shortage. And I mean, that's probably another topic to discuss.
Well, I mean, we work nationally. I'm originally from Melbourne. I've always worked nationally, and now I live in Queensland. So, I can tell you, I mean, you know, it's always one of those things, and you kind of go, well, I think that's the other thing is that thinking, and that's why it's good, you know, when you work for a firm that is national. But if you also think as an architect that it's an experience, you can travel the world and work as an architect. You can live in different states and experience different things. And I think if you have a bit more of that migratory view, you can actually get exposure to a lot. So, you know, the Melbourne market might be a bit quieter right now, but the Brisbane market hasn't built the amount of architects for the design and the what's going to come. And so it's a perfect place to be. right? And
at the moment we've got over $100,000. There's a skills shortage of over 100,000 people to build what they're asking to build by 2030.
Absolutely.
In New South Wales. So,
wow. In New South Wales.
So, there is a major, not just in architecture and the built environment, but the skills in trades. It's huge. So, we will be okay from from a business perspective, and that's probably why we're growing.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is a shortage elsewhere.
Oh, and look, there absolutely is, and I mean that's going to be part of growing internally, but it's also going to be migration as well, and that's why we're so lucky in this country. We're looking about 200, 250, I think it's about 220 is the numbers I think they've been stated for Queensland alone.
Right.
And, you know, there is so many opportunities for people to be able to expand and get exposure. I mean, I'm going to be a massive advocate of Queensland, obviously, because I chose to live here. I'm also a massive advocate. I live in Sydney, but my partner won't. But, yes, the weather and the opportunities are endless. Excellent. Now, look, now we always finish on a bit of a recommendation on what you would recommend as in people you follow or podcasts or books or things like that you think are worth people checking out.
Some of the podcasts that I've been listening to are The Future Women.
Oh, cool. Yeah.
Yeah. Yes. It's really, really exciting. I mean, there's a lot of stories that you can hear about women's experiences and how they've overcome them and how they've been able to develop strong relationships with other women and how to help women throughout the industry. And I'm a huge advocate for that.
Absolutely.
So, and I have helped a lot of women in their careers, and I continue to do so. Until the numbers equalize, I will continue to do so.
And look, it's fantastic to hear. It's often when people say to me, you know, what should our DEI targets for gender be? And I'm like, well, it should be a representation of the community and and if people are like, oh, it's over 50. I'm like, yeah, it should be over 50%. If 80%
people
are interiors and
we're over 50. 5%. Yeah, we're over 50 at Jackson Tees, but we're still lacking the equilibrium at that leadership, and that's what we're working towards.
Yeah, and it's a really important thing for firms to be quite conscious of and asking their people as well. So there's different 100%. Strategies and being, as you said, a champion, a representative champions of change, it's great to see what the industry is doing.
Wonderful.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for all of your time. It's been a fantastic conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure.